Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The trial of presidential candidate John Edwards begins today, and experts say the trial will have ramifications far beyond the saga of his adulterous affair and child with filmmaker Riel Hunter during the 2008 White House campaign. Edwards is facing 6 criminal charges related to nearly $1 million in secret payments from 2 wealthy supporters. The Federal Elections Commission declined to pursue charges, but the Justice Department's Public Integrity Section is. George Washington University Law Professor Jonathan Turley is here to help us sort of launch the case. Jonathan, let's follow the money, that $1 million. Where did it go? So you tell us a little bit about the story. And what is, you know, what are the legal arguments from both sides?
Well, it's obviously a case that has great salacious interest for the public, but it's an important legal case. Once you tear away the headline grabbing aspects of it, and also this idea of a presidential candidate who's trying to hide an affair from the public. But when you drill down a bit, there's an important legal issue. Here we have a wealthy donor named Rachel Bunny Mellon and another close friend, Fred Barron, who gave money to help Ms. Hunter when she was carrying the child of Mr. Edwards. The money certainly helped Edwards in his campaign in the sense that the scandal did not really reach the public until long after his campaign was over. But the government is arguing that that money truly constitutes a campaign contribution and therefore the misuse of campaign contributions. And so you'll hear in court this following the bunny money, as they say, looking at who got the money and how. The defense is saying that Edwards never really knew about the money, that it was solicited by a third party, this former aide who once claimed to be the father of the child, Andrew Young. And so what you have then is the government saying that even if a third party is giving money to another third party, if it benefits the candidate, it can be a campaign contribution. That's the basis of 4 counts in this complaint for illegal campaign contributions. There's also 1 count for conspiracy and 1 count for false statements. Those are more conventional allegations. But it's really those 4 campaign contributions that raise the eyebrows of many attorneys, because it would frankly expand quite significantly what is considered a campaign contribution. It would throw into question when a candidate receives a free gym membership or other types of benefits from third parties. Now, Edwards has a very interesting claim here, and one that may resonate with some of the jurors. His defense is saying, look, he had a motivation for this. It's the oldest motivation known to mankind. He was trying to hide an affair from his wife.
Especially his very ill and dying wife.
Exactly. So you have this really fascinating question of, you know, a cheating husband, by definition, wants to do everything he can to hide his adultery from his spouse. And yet this cheating husband certainly had another motive, in the sense that anyone who found out about it would hate him, which most people do right now. So how do you comb out these differences? How do you say that his motivation was for the campaign as opposed to the more traditional husband hiding an affair motivation?
Right. Well, and just briefly, we only have a few seconds here, Jonathan Turley, but how does this play out politically? We know that at least 5 current administration or Obama campaign officials are on witness lists. Just briefly.
Well, it could be quite explosive because both sides are going to drill down very hard on those witnesses, and Edwards may not be the only one left embarrassed in this trial.
Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. As the Jonathan Edwards trial begins in North Carolina, jury selection begins today. Trial expected to go for 6 weeks. And so I am sure we will have you back as this plays out. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, over the next couple of days, we want to take a look at hazing and a warning. What we're going to hear will make Animal House look tame. This month, 5 Boston University students were found in an off-campus fraternity basement, their hands tied, covered in welts. Their frat, Alpha Epsilon Pi, was shut down by its national leaders. Four Cornell University Sigma Alpha Epsilon brothers face criminal charges in the death of a pledge last year. Cornell shut down the local chapter of SAE, and the school's president is ordering a revamping of pledging by next fall. Binghamton University in New York has banned fraternities and sororities on campus from accepting new members while that school investigates allegations of hazing. So what will Dartmouth do? 22-year-old Andrew Lose was a member of Dartmouth's SAE. In January, he blew the whistle on their hazing in a column in the school newspaper. He says school officials rebuffed him and students shunned him. Then just this past Friday, Dartmouth sentenced SAE to a 3-term probationary period. We're going to hear more about that in a minute. But Andrew, who took a medical leave to go through rehab, tells us that punishment is a slap on the wrist. And this isn't a position he ever wanted to be in. Let's welcome Andrew Lose. He joins us from New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
We know Dartmouth was the inspiration for Animal House. It has a reputation for partying. Your grandfather and brother went there, so you knew that. You wanted a part of this.
Yeah, I was certainly aware of it. You know, but I remember visiting my brother at Dartmouth for the first time. He was a freshman. I was a junior in high school. And I still remember being kind of confused of walking into the fraternity for the first time and seeing this beautiful kind of mansion on the outside and walking in, and it's just this gutted, gross, this is Dartmouth. I knew about the drinking and that reputation, but I thought maybe some guys sitting around a wood-paneled room drinking scotch and debating some kind of philosophical argument and not the kind of, sad alcoholic landscape I found when I visited there.
Well, but still, as you said, you did want it, this idea of the Dartmouth man, which your grandfather, who you idolized, had been. So when SAE came knocking on your door, and that's what happens, it's the middle of the night, you're ordered out of bed, and you are alerted that you're going to be a pledge. What happened? I mean, just it's kind of gruesome, but what are some of the things that you say you were asked to do?
Well, there was a lot of drinking involved, obviously. There's a real blackout culture at Dartmouth. There was one instance where all the pledges had to chug 2 cups of vinegar from a dirty mop bucket, actually. Mm. On one of the first nights of pledging, we swam in a pool of this foul mixture, which, we weren't told what it was at the time. Later, brothers had said that there were certain bodily fluids in it. Some said there weren't. Not really sure what to believe until then, later, seeing this mixture prepared for the future pledges and seeing that there were, in fact, those bodily fluids in it.
Well, Dartmouth frat boys pride themselves on being able to drink 6 cups of beer in less than 30 seconds.
Yeah. You really get worn down constantly being asked to do these chores and tasks and all these gross things for the older brothers. And eventually it just wears down any kind of resolve that you have. And it's upsetting. It can really be upsetting. And that's why I've tried to point out that this is not just a physical issue. It's an emotional and psychological issue. I mean, and it kind of is a form of bullying, but it's a highly organized form of bullying. I mean, it really devalues you. And then through that process, you tend to think that you're no good on your own. You're only good as a member of this group. And that's really dangerous thinking.
Tell us about some of the psychological things you were put through. There came a point where, I mean, you and the other pledges have done so much. People who have pledged are familiar with this. And and then there's a moment where you're completely broken down, where you're told you might not make it.
Well, you're told that you might not make it the whole time, and that's how the brothers get you to do all these things, that you really wouldn't otherwise do. The night when they came to deliver the bids, this older brother who had tried to blackball me lit my bid card on fire, this card they give you to signify that you've been accepted, and said that I had to do a quick 6 in the amount of time it took for the card to burn.
And that's six beers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long. I mean, the card burned rather quickly, and I couldn't drink the beers quickly enough. And then so he said, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to go home now. So, I mean, this whole idea of, well, you're not good enough, you have to do X, Y, and Z, I mean, this starts from the very beginning. But there's such a cognitive dissonance between, we love you, we're your best friends. This is coming from the brothers. We love you, we're your best friends, or we hate you, and you have to do all these things if you want to be one of us.
Well, there are other things. You say you were forced to eat omelets made of vomit. I mean, it goes on and on. Others have come forward, as you know, from SAE and said, it's not true. There wasn't really vomit in kiddie pools that you had to swim through. That was just, we just told pledges that.
Yeah. Well, what do you think they're going to do? Fraternity hazing at Dartmouth has gone on for such a long time. It's been an open secret. but no one has really literally come out and kind of enumerated what happened in their experience in their fraternity. You're kind of ashamed of what happened usually, and you just want to keep self-justifying, and that's how the system perpetuates itself.
Well, in fact, another Dartmouth alum, Snowden Wright, wrote an op-ed in the New York Daily News called In Defense of Hazing, and he talked about something called pulling the trigger, where pledges would force themselves to vomit in order to keep on drinking, and pledges weren't allowed to do it to themselves. Other pledges had to do it to each other. And he said, it was like watching two kittens licking each other, pure friendship. I know this is disgusting to some people, and I apologize, but we have to sort of get at this because he's saying that this is what happened. And before you wrote your column, you went to the school and told the school that, you know, there was a health crisis and something should be done about it. In an irony, because none of the other students would talk about what was going on, you ended up being potentially the only one who might have been charged with any of this. Now, all the charges have been dropped, but you, the whistleblower, might have been the one to actually get in trouble for hazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, not all the charges have been dropped. I mean, right now, the charges against the organization itself still stand. I'm happy that the charges against these individuals were dropped. I mean, I don't think that throwing 27 guys under the bus for this type of stuff is going to change it. I mean, what I've been trying to push for from the very beginning is a more broad-based reform. These hazing abuses happen at literally almost every fraternity at Dartmouth. I mean, my experience is pretty middle of the road. So we need to go after the organizations and push for a real structural systemic reform and not just try to pretend that this is some kind of thing that individuals do.
Well, the very well-known lawyer Harvey Silverglade is representing SAE. He tells Rolling Stone that your allegations are demonstrably untrue and said you were unstable. Let's talk a little bit about where you are in all of this, because you talk about the sense of entitlement of students at Dartmouth. And as you freely say, you had that sense too. I mean, you got very drunk at one point and threw a chair at a Dartmouth security guard. You did cocaine in the frat house. Another brother busted you. He called security. You were suspended from the school for a year. Are you just a disgruntled former pledge, which is what some are saying?
Well, I mean, let me just say the issue of whether hazing happens or not, the book is closed on that. It happens. I mean, this has been proven. And any kind of push in another direction is just a way to kind of shoot the messenger. And, you know, as to the argument about, well, you know, Los has sour grapes and, you know, he's just making stuff up for revenge. You know, I don't have any ill will against the fraternity or the brothers. I mean, I'm kind of moved beyond that. And that's evidenced by the fact that when those 27 individuals were charged, I wrote a long letter to the college expressing that I would not participate as a witness in this investigation that targeted individuals instead of going after the broader problem.
That's Andrew Lose. He wrote a column about hazing in the Dartmouth School paper and was just featured in a Rolling Stone piece. We're going to hear more from him in a minute, but also get response from a Dartmouth dean. Meanwhile, what about your thoughts? Students, is this overblown? Or are a parent of a student maybe at Dartmouth, horrified at what you just heard? Or are these traditions you support? Maybe generally, generationally, your family has gone through this. Let us know. HereAndNow.org. Back in 1 minute. Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with Andrew Lose about hazing. He says he blew the whistle on hazing at a chapter of SAE at Dartmouth and was shunned. And then just this past Friday, the school did punish the fraternity, as we'll hear. And Andrew, there's been a lot of response to your claims. Ariana Duggan, a Dartmouth alum who was in a sorority, doesn't dispute what you say, but she wrote in the Huffington Post that reform should come from students, not from school officials. And she also says no one forced you to pledge or stay in when you were hazed.
Yeah, you know, that's a real oversimplification. You know, there's such a great social pressure at Dartmouth to, especially for men, you know, to be members of fraternities. To have any kind of social relevance, you really have to be in a fraternity. This is kind of a real groupthink type of thing. It's a Stockholm syndrome when you're a pledge and you begin to associate with the people asking you to do awful things or doing awful things to you. But these are not things that people would do to each other, especially not, you know, bright, ambitious kids would do to each other on a one-on-one basis. Yet somehow these collective organizations with a kind of elite mentality can permit these things to happen.
Well, you say they wouldn't do it as individuals, but maybe they then go on to do it in another group. Another SAE brother tells Rolling Stone that Wall Street recruiters used to come and watch some of the hazing. Dartmouth is known for sending its grads to Wall Street. And this brother says, therefore, the corporate milieu mirrors the fraternity culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. You know, that there's a corporate recruiting culture at Dartmouth which sweeps people away in the same way that the fraternity culture does. And it's the same kind of attitudes, you know, this attitude of, you know, the ends always justifying the means, you know, always protect the firm or, you know, always protect the fraternity, keep the secrets. I mean, this culture is a breeding ground for people who go on into the broader 1% culture, as, you know, we call it these days.
Well, Andrew Lohse, you made your appeal in a column in the school paper, and you made it directly to the school's president, Jim Yong Kim. He's since been appointed president of the World Bank. But he was very supportive of the fraternity culture. He said he had no control over it. The previous president at Dartmouth tried to do something about the fraternity culture and was completely attacked by on- and off-campus fraternity members. Do you think anything's going to happen?
I'm an optimist, but, you know, not much has changed. I mean, there are some task forces now. There are some committees. But, I mean, President Kim was quoted once saying that he thought the fraternities were good for the heart. You know, and that was his view as a physician. What if Dr. Kim had walked into the basement when the pledges were swimming in the kiddie pool of this gross mixture? I mean, I don't think he would have been saying then that fraternities were good for the heart.
Do you think someone has to die, which is what happened at Cornell, and now they're moving to shut down pledging?
That's a really hard issue for me. I think that might be the only thing that it will take. But even then, I get the feeling that even then, diehard fraternity, you know, guys and deep-pocketed donors who were affiliated with the fraternity system and have made it clear, and the Board of Trustees have made it clear that you just can't touch the Greek system. Even some of those people, I don't think, would be moved by someone dying. And it's not inconceivable. You know, with the way the forced drinking happens, it's just simply not inconceivable that a pledge will die at some point due to intoxication. I mean, it's going to happen eventually. And me saying, "I told you so," is not going to bring that person back.
Andrew Lohse, the subject of a new Rolling Stone article, Confessions of an Ivy League Frat Boy, Inside Dartmouth's Hazing Abuses. Andrew, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, as we mentioned, this past Friday, Andrew's old fraternity, SAE, was sentenced to a 3-term probationary period. No alcohol will be allowed at SAE parties at Dartmouth. The frat will have to come up with a policy to prevent hazing in the future and join in a campus-wide education program. Dean Charlotte Johnson of Dartmouth joins us. And Dean, your school's investigation admits that some of the things he claimed did happen. He says earlier complaints to officials fell on deaf ears.
That couldn't be further from accurate. His complaints did not fall on deaf ears. There's plenty of evidence that contradicts that. And the most significant evidence, I think, comes from our joint investigation with the Hanover Police Department in 2009 when Mr. Lohse initially raised these allegations.
There was a local police investigation, and they didn't find anything. But I guess the question is also, do you really believe that this is just SAE and that it's just SAE that needs to be addressed? As Andrew Lohse just said, he'd like to see the whole system addressed.
This is not about Mr. Lohse, nor is it exclusively about SAE. This is about what we're going to do as an institution to make sure that we end hazing on this campus. We are openly saying that hazing does occur on Dartmouth's campus, as it does across the country.
Even though it's illegal, we should point out, in the state.
Well, even it is illegal in the state, it is illegal in many other states. This is really about a few things. How do we reform? How do we prevent hazing from causing serious injury? How do we prevent a death? This has to be a situation where we tackle the issue as a community, faculty, students, the administration, and even alumni.
How much pressure do you get from alumni, from students on campus? We remember when a past president tried to do something about pledging, there were protests outside his home, huge banners were dropped, and we know alumni who are also donors put pressure on the school.
I've not encountered any alumni personally who come to me and say, "Look, I support hazing." The entire community is on the same page with respect to the fact that we have got to put an end and we will not tolerate these sorts of behaviors because of the harm that they have the potential to cause.
And how do you do that? You know, who decides what is unhealthy? Blindfolding kids, maybe, and you don't know that one of those kids may have some emotional problems and they get let off into the woods and left there, or it's more obvious, forcing somebody to drink so much alcohol that they throw up blood. That seems pretty obvious, but what's unhealthy pledging?
There may be gray areas with respect to what constitutes hazing and what doesn't. For instance, is a group of students required to wear beanie caps? Is that hazing? And what I've said to those sorts of questions is, right now our focus has to be on not who's wearing a beanie. We have to focus on that sort of activity which could lead to serious injuries, psychological harm, or death. Let's begin there. And I think where Dartmouth has taken a leadership role is in its willingness to confront the issues openly.
That's Charlotte Johnson, Dean of the College at Dartmouth. Dean Johnson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, tomorrow we'll continue our look at hazing and look at how Cornell is pledging to reform it by next fall after a pledge there died. So how would you do that? Let us know. HereAndNow.org. Latest news is next. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Harvard Art Museums, from Chinese jades to Jasper Johns, Byzantium to Bernini. Learn more at harvardartmuseums.org. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture. ICABoston.org.
Facebook is applauding a pending law in Maryland that would prohibit employers from asking prospective or current employees to hand over their login information for social media sites. Another bill that didn't pass would have applied the ban to universities. The employer ban was approved earlier this month. It awaits the governor's signature, and lawmakers in Michigan, Illinois, and California are considering similar measures. But the Maryland Chamber of Commerce is among the ban's opponents. They say social media postings can help weed out bad job applicants, like those at a state corrections department who posed online showing gang signs. Catherine Ho is Capital Business Reporter for The Washington Post. Catherine, let's remind people how it works. If you have someone's username and password on, say, Facebook, you can log in and see all their postings, no matter what their privacy settings are.
Yes, that's right.
And this law was launched by something that happened with a corrections officer. What happened?
Well, a couple of years ago, the State Division of Corrections had this policy that said they could ask for prospective employees' login information. And there was one officer, his name was Robert Collins, he was doing a recertification interview with the supervisor, and the supervisor asked for his Facebook username and password. And, he ended up, handing it over. He felt like he was pressured to do that, but he was very uncomfortable with it. So he, later got hooked up with the Maryland ACLU, and the ACLU is really the organization that kind of got this into the public spotlight. They wrote a letter to the public safety secretary saying, this policy is a violation of privacy, basically, and not just privacy, of Mr. Collins, but of his friends and his family members who might also appear somehow on his Facebook page. So they're the ones that really were behind this change. They got in touch with state legislators, and I guess now here we are.
Well, what is the prison saying in defense of doing this? I mean, what do they find when they go on social media?
Sure. Well, the whole point of the policy is really to screen for any possible gang affiliations of these prospective employees. If you think about the job description of a corrections officer, that's really not something you want them to be affiliated with in their past. So that was really their rationale. It's part of a background check process.
Well, after the ACLU complained, the department did change its policy. But as we said, now the Maryland legislature is involved. They've drafted this bill, which would prohibit employers from asking for password information. But other businesses are upset. What are they saying?
Well, they say, an employer should really be able to know some of this stuff before they hire someone. And whether it comes from their Facebook or their Twitter, it's something that employers want to know before they hire someone. They want to know more about them.
I guess the thing that this bill has also got us asking is, does this mean that if there isn't a law in your state saying that employers can't ask you to hand over your password information, that they can?
They can ask, and you can voluntarily hand it over. There's nothing specific in other states banning it yet. My understanding is it's a relatively rare practice. I mean, not every employer you go interview with is probably going to ask you for that. But this just kind of adds an extra layer of protection for employees to be able to say, no, it's against the law, you know, should an employer ask you for that information.
Well, in the meantime, you know, it's always a cautionary tale. You know, you always say to people, don't put anything on Facebook you wouldn't want people to see, but you can put up privacy settings so only your friends can see things, which is why, you know, employers would have to ask you for the login. And now Senators Chuck Schumer and Richard Blumenthal have asked Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate whether asking for login information during job interviews violates federal law. So that's pending. Meanwhile, where do you think this is going to go? Do you think the sense is that it will be taken up on the federal level?
I'm not sure about that. I think this is something that a lot of states are talking about right now. I think it may be a little early to be talking about federal law, but I do think this is something that's on the minds of obviously a lot of legislators. A lot of employers are talking about it. So, you know, I don't see the issue going away anytime soon. I think it's only going to become bigger and bigger.
I'm thinking, too, that if an employer really wanted to, they could do something, you know, like have their child friend you
and right,
you know,
right.
Send a Trojan horse into your Facebook and they can see it that way. It's just, I think it's always just a good idea to remember, you know, somebody could get in.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that this bill doesn't deal with is the many other ways an employer can find your tweets if you don't have your privacy settings up. And even if you do, there are plenty of ways that information ends up on the web anyways.
Yeah. Catherine Ho, Capital Business Reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And staying with privacy issues, up next, the Murdoch hacking scandal chugs along. We'll check in 30 seconds here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. And to Britain now, and the phone hacking scandal, which has spread to another arm of Rupert Murdoch's media empire there. Today, the head of Sky News acknowledged to a panel investigating journalistic standards that the company did indeed hack emails, breaking the law. He also admitted that earlier his television station misled the senior judge leading the panel, and he apologized. Of course, you remember Rupert Murdoch was forced to close his top-selling newspaper, The News of the World, after the revelations that reporters hacked into people's emails, cell phones, and also bribed sources. Murdoch and his son James are scheduled to answer questions from the so-called Leveson Inquiry, named after Judge Brian Leveson, later this week. The BBC's Rob Watson joins us from London. So, Rob, previously, Sky News denied they'd intercepted any communications.
That is right, and that was one of the awkward moments for the Sky News editor, because he had to say to the inquiry, whoops, when I came before you before and said we hadn't done any hacking at Sky Television News, he was forced to say, well, of course, we had. It's not, of course, new in Britain that there had been this case of hacking, because a few weeks ago Sky had said that they had done this, but they had defended it, saying, unlike perhaps other cases of hacking, this was clearly in the public interest. And they implied that they very much had the backing of police and prosecutors in this particular case, because they had, after all, uncovered fraud for which somebody was eventually prosecuted.
This is the case that John Riley points to, hacking the accounts of John and Anne Darwin. They're the so-called canoe couple. They became notorious in Britain after John Darwin faked his own death in a boating accident as part of an elaborate insurance scam. So John Riley saying, you know, this was sort of a necessary evil, but what is the legal weight there? I mean, is this hacking inquiry going to accept that it's okay to hack if someone's seen as a villain, but not okay if they're not?
Well, this was the other unfortunate moment for John Riley, where the head of the inquiry, Judge Leveson, interrupted at one point and said, are you saying that hacking is in some way legal, that this is okay? And there was a bit of a pause, and looking somewhat like a naughty schoolboy, he said no. He was also asked whether this was something within the broadcasting guidelines in Britain, and again Mr. Riley said no.
But John Riley also said to the panel, it's highly unlikely in the future that Sky will consider breaking the law, to which the panel replied, wait, you're not ruling it out? And he said, well, I'm pretty much ruling it out, but there might be an occasion, but it would be very, very rare.
This is something that we've seen before at the Leveson Inquiry, and we've certainly seen it before in the broader defence of freedom of the press in Britain. And I think we're going to see a lot more of it in the next couple of days, and that is newspapers and other broadcast media saying, well, not that we're promising or threatening future law breaking, but they are very keen on this idea of a public interest defence. And of course, the case that comes most prominently to mind is the expose of the MP's expenses here, swimming pools and duck ponds and all this kind of thing, and moats being cleaned around houses. Now, of course, the particular paper involved in that expose, the Daily Telegraph, had essentially had to pay a civil servant and had to pay a contact for information. So the way they got it, if you like, was illegal. Now, as far as I know, there isn't a single politician brave enough to say, well, he shouldn't have broken the law. So I think we're always going to see the media in Britain wanting to reserve that right of a public interest defence against allegations of criminal wrongdoing.
By the way, does Britain have a Supreme Court? You know, the idea that, well, let's let them break the law again and do hacking again and take it all the way that is to the Supreme Court, which, of course, we have here.
Absolutely. And, of course, the media have gone lots of times to the courts in Britain to say, well, I know that someone has objected to this, the way in which we got this story or to this story, but I guess what the Leveson inquiry wants to look at is not always the exceptional cases, the really striking things like MPs' expenses. But I think what they've been more worried about is, what do you do about levels of privacy that ordinary individuals or famous individuals should enjoy? And how should the process of checks and balances and redress work without necessarily having to go to the, I guess you might call it the nuclear option of having to go to the Supreme Court? So I don't think that the Leveson inquiry is really intending to deal with these really big cases. It's more the day-to-day operation of the press in Britain.
Well, meanwhile, this week, James Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's son, is scheduled to testify tomorrow, in fact. He resigned as executive chair of News International in February because of this hacking scandal. He and his father have already testified before Parliament over this. How will the testimony for James Murdoch be different tomorrow?
I think it'll be different in the sense that the Leveson inquiry, it's also looking at the relationship between the powerful people in the press, its owners, and the politicians. So I think you're going to see a lot of questioning of both James Murdoch and I think even more of his father, Rupert, in, well, what exactly is it that you get from the contacts that you've had with politicians? And so although James Murdoch is clearly going to face an awful grilling, one presumes, about the kind of things that went wrong at News International under his watch, I suspect politicians of all colours are going to be rather nervous about what the Murdochs will say over the next couple of days about how the politicians have courted them.
We know that in the testimony in July, Rupert Murdoch talked about visiting Downing Street and being friendly with both Gordon Brown and David Cameron. Meanwhile, what's the public feeling there? Rupert Murdoch always positioned himself as a man of the people, you know, taking down the giants. What's the sense of people there now about him?
I've always got the sense that people have never really much warmed to him one way or another over the last 40, 50 years that he's been involved in the media in the UK. But I think what's much more interesting is the attitude of the politicians and the elite, who, of course, have spent the last few decades courting Rupert Murdoch, hoping that his newspaper and media empire were going to support this or that cause or campaign. Now, they have clearly turned against Rupert Murdoch in a very major way. It's been quite striking, some might say rather sick-making, to see how all these people that wanted to rush to his various annual parties have now turned against him. So that's the interesting thing, rather than how does he figure with the British public. I guess one super interesting question to ask would be, how does Rupert Murdoch feel about Britain these days?
Meaning, might he just pull up stakes and take his toys and leave?
I don't think there's any sign of that, and certainly the broadcasting, the pay-per-view broadcasting here is extremely profitable and extremely successful, but I think some have speculated that perhaps when Rupert Murdoch in particular appears before the Leveson inquiry, people aren't expecting him to take it lying down, and there's been plenty of stuff in the media in Britain suggesting that he's very angry with politicians who he feels have let him down, people that had previously courted his approval. So I don't think he's going to be too shy necessarily about letting his feelings be known.
The BBC's Rob Watson in London. Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Quick note, tomorrow the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones will be in our studios. He's already arrived wearing his Red Sox. He'll be here tomorrow, Here and Now. Welcome back.
Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I wanna really, really, really wanna zig a zig.
Any excuse. Just have a programming note. Later this week, we're going to hear from the Beijing Auto Show, and we like this song, so we thought we'd get this item out of the way. The Spice Girl, formerly known as Posh, now known as Victoria Beckham, one half of the Uber couple that includes soccer star David Beckham, is in China for the Beijing show, selling Land Rovers. She was a design consultant for the Land Rover Avoc. Motor Authority website says that what's called vintage-inspired tan leather seats, mohair floor mats, and a set of luggage bound in hand-sewn leather, all of it signed by Ms. Beckham, are inside. And that might explain the $129,000 price tag. Well, anyway, as we said later this week, news from the auto show.
What you think about that? Now you know how I feel.
All right, now to an age-old conflict.
I thought I saw a pretty cat. I did saw a pretty cat.
Hello, breakfast.
You bad old pickin' tomcat.
I'm still laughing. But in Looney Tunes, Tweety Bird always outwits poor Sylvester the cat. Not the case in the backyard of Lydia Ledinsky in Concord, Massachusetts. The town that prides itself as being one of the birthplaces of the American Revolution is now in the middle of another battle. Lydia says neighborhood cats destroyed her backyard bird sanctuary despite a 6-foot fence. And while many towns require that cats be licensed or spayed and neutered, Lydia wants Concord to join Aurora, Colorado, Akron, Ohio, Montgomery County, Maryland, Palm Beach, Florida, and New Orleans, Louisiana, with laws that regulate cats' wanderings, some of them including leash laws. Lydia Ledinsky's petitions are being taken up by Concord's town meeting. That begins tonight. She joins us in the studio with more. Lydia, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And this is sort of, you know, not since, you know, the shot that was fired has there been such a controversy. This becomes very important and personal to people. Now, we know your yard had many birds, and you and your mom, who's since died, used to sit out there and enjoy them. This was your sanctuary. How bad did it get? How bad was the carnage?
I have seen significant differences in the past 3 years, and I can just give you one simple example. We had 6 bluebirds that were living in the yard 3 years ago that were wintering through and nesting in our yard. As of 2 years ago, that went down to 4. And then last year, we had 2 females and 1 male left, and the cat actually got both of the females.
Oh, boy.
So this year we had 1 male left, and it was the saddest thing because for 3 weeks we had to listen to him with the mating calls searching because they are territorial. There were no more females left in the area.
Okay, and you're saying all sorts of others have gone too. Well, did you, you know, so you know these cats. Did you talk to your neighbors?
Yes, I actually spoke with my neighbors over a period of 2.5 months.
They actually coined a term for the cats, did they not?
Yes. Terrorist cats.
So they know, you know, they knew that their cats were causing carnage, but what?
They felt that it was their privilege to allow the cats to roam free. That was one reason that they gave me. And then the other one was that she simply had no more time and energy to deal with the cats with the children that in the house at the time.
All right. So now you propose 3 articles. One is that the town hire an animal control officer. Like many towns, you have a dog officer, but you want one that oversees all animals. And there's another article that will require licensing and vaccination. And you're saying that if cats are found trespassing, what, 3 times?
Yeah, we try to be a little lenient since I would assume there's a learning curve. The first time there's no penalty involved and the animal control officer would come to the person's home and say, hey, look, you know, the neighbor here is not happy with your cat roaming in the yard. Can you do something about it? And we just wanted to let you know. And then the second time there's a financial fee and then the third time as well. And then I suggested the fourth time we also set up a committee where the committee would meet with the people and try to mediate for this.
And beyond that, are you calling for cats to be impounded or picked up? Or
the interesting thing is that if we don't pass this bylaw, we can impound those cats. Right now, if the cats aren't registered and they're roaming in the yard, they really aren't considered anyone's cat. Mm. So it would be in the best interest of people to vote for this to protect their cats from people who would be calling and complaining about them.
Well, that's your point of view. But as you know, others are saying, you know darn well that's my cat. Are you also suggesting that, you know, since there would be this law, people should either keep their cats indoors or walk them on leashes, maybe?
There are beautiful and very creative solutions with enclosures for cats these days that allow cats to be outside, but yet within their own yards. And I have over 85 different pictures and wonderful internet sites that have suggestions for creating these enclosures for cats.
Okay, so there is that option. Don't you think it's against the nature of a cat to keep it, you know, you're not suggesting leashes, but to constrain it?
I think it all depends on how you raise and train that animal, whether you've raised and trained it from the time that the cat was a kitten, whether you've acquired a cat as an adopted adult cat, whether you've taken on a feral cat into your home. I know a number of people who've taken on feral cats into their home, and the transition to indoor cats has been remarkable, and they would not let that cat out anymore because they recognize the dangers of letting those cats out.
Well, okay, then it's time for full disclosure, because I have a cat who got hit so many times by cars that I converted her to an indoor cat. She now goes out on a leash with me. She's fine.
That's wonderful.
She's fine. And, you know, the Virginia-based American Bird Conservancy agrees with you. They run a Keep Cats Indoors campaign. Many veterinarians agree with you. They say, you know, not only are cats whacked by cars like mine was, but they can also catch leukemia from each other when they fight. You can pass it between cats. So many city vets are recommending that cats stay indoors. But, you know, this is not a popular suggestion. What would you say to people about, you know, the whole reasoning behind this for you, your love of birds? Obviously, something very powerful has happened or isn't happening for you anymore for you to do this.
Everything has changed in the yard. I mean, it's not just the birds. There's no more chipmunks. The squirrels are gone. The number of species has decreased tremendously. And I'm not saying that the cats are to blame about all this. I mean, there's, you know, roadkill and cars and different birds and hawks and things of that sort that are also a threat to the birds. But I know that these cats made these differences because I saw that. And it just doesn't seem right that this is allowed, first of all, because it is my yard. And second, I just have a hard time understanding and believing that people will just disrespect our wishes as neighbors. And right then and there, we have a falling out now in the neighborhood and the community that didn't exist before this, because the cats have caused this tension now between the neighbors that we're not even speaking anymore. And that kind of relationship is not going to foster well in the community.
Yeah. Well, this is going to go before your town meeting. We'll see how it plays out. Lydia Ledinsky of Concord, Massachusetts, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about your hope that your neighbors will keep their cats at home.
Thank you, Robin.
And I'm telling you, my cat goes to the leash on the door and paws it when she wants to go out. But if you have the cat who pictures itself the front line against mice in the barn, this might not work. So let us know your thoughts at hereandnow.org. And in honor of Tweety Bird, you can also tweet us at Here and Now or at Here and Now Robin. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us to see what the week brings. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.